This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Flash flooding in August 2018 devastated communities along the Kickapoo River who've repeatedly been hit by high waters over the last decade. Now, a recently awarded federal grant hopes to help four of those villages plan for ways to make their community more resilient to future floods. Joining us to talk about the grant and how the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission will help these villages is Dave Boniface, the new executive director of the commission, and Greg Flogstead, the former director of the commission. So this grant is for $740,000 and comes from the U.S. Department of Commerce's Economic Development Administration. And Greg, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why the commission wanted to apply for this money.
Well, it all started back in, like you said, right after the flood in 2018, where we looked at, the communities looked at what happened in Gaze Mills, Wisconsin. And what happened there was actually a FEMA team that was available for the community to call on, made up of planners, a civil engineer, a GIS mapping specialist, a public relations person, that was essentially embedded in the community from August through December of 2008 or 2009. And during that time, they developed a plan for the community, a lot of public meetings and everything, where they decided what they wanted to do, where they wanted to go, and the type of community they wanted to build in the future. And then this flood came along in 2018 for these four communities, and this FEMA team was no longer in place. So we, in talking with the communities, we decided to apply for a grant where they would end up hiring a team, a consulting firm, so to speak, to take on the task similar to what this FEMA team did in Gaze Mills.
And how do we know that kind of taking a similar approach to what Gaze Mills did for these new four villages, Ontario, Lafarge, Reedstown, and Viola, how do we know that that's a good fit?
Well, they all had very similar flooding problems. Two of the communities already had identified some areas where they wanted to move to, but they just didn't have the funding to do it. And this funding, if you add the funding, the federal funding and the local match together, each community is going to have about $200,000 to be able to do planning and preliminary engineering work as to, well, however they see fit to use that money to plan for the future.
Dave, I wonder if you can explain in more specifically, kind of when we're talking about this grant, what this money will go towards specifically for each of these communities.
Well, the grant, basically each, like Greg said, each of them will have $200,000, and we'll be hiring a consultant, and the consultant will do a facilities assessment, what type of public facilities they have, where they're located, a public infrastructure assessment, roads, sewer lines, water lines. They'll do some real estate appraisals for the existing facilities that are in the floodplain and then outside of it to see to get a cost estimate. Environmental assessments will be done if required. There'll also be a large public, like Greg said, large public participation. They'll be holding numerous meetings because we want the publics, the people that live there, to have input on this. We don't want somebody coming in and saying, this is what you should do. We want you to voice your opinion, how this can help our community. And then at the end, similar to what Gaze Mills did, and the Gaze Mills example, planning team came back with four options. These are the options, and then the community chose which was best for them. So the community is getting a lot of assessment analysis from this consultant and developing into one major plan that, you know, they'll have input into as to where they would like to move. One of the key issues that we have is that these communities are smaller communities, and they can't sustain a huge loss of tax base. So if the residentials or the commercials move out, that's a huge loss to them. So we're trying to identify spots within their community so that these businesses and homes can be moved, but yet stay within the community.
And what role will the Planning Commission play in all of this?
We'll administer the grant. We'll oversee. We'll be the between the communities and the consultant. We'll develop the RFP, make sure that's being followed, do all the reporting required for the grant. So we'll be the in-between person. We'll administer the grant itself.
And Dave, I wonder, you know, how could taking this more regional approach, not just looking at a village as an individual, but looking at these four villages, you know, together, how do you think that will help these projects?
There's a lot of information that they can, it'll go from one community to the next, so, and then they won't have to reinvent the wheel. So they can take ideas from one community to the next community. So hopefully we can get a cost savings for that. They can get more of their bang for their buck, because if a consultant does for more than one of the communities, you can gather data and other stuff that'll be similar to them. So hopefully there'll be some cost savings in there. And I mean, they're in the Kickapoo. They're all very much similar in geography, so we should be able to transfer some of the ideas from one community to the next.
And it was mentioned that there is a local match to this federal money. Where will that local money be coming from?
Each community receives some money from the Ho-Chunk Nation. The Ho-Chunk Nation gives Vernon County a certain amount of money each year. And then Vernon County divvies up that money however they see fit. And in this situation, communities applied to Vernon County for some of that money. So each of the communities will be getting $40,000 for hazard mitigation planning situations. So and they chose to use it for this.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking about a new federal grant that will help four villages along the Kickapoo River build resiliency against future floods. We're here with Dave Boniface, Executive Director of the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission, and Greg Flogstad, the former director of the commission. Greg, you know, it was mentioned that this is very similar to the project that happened in Gays Mills, and I wonder if you could describe in more detail the steps that Gays Mills took to make their community more resilient to floods.
Well, it's kind of like a similarity would be if you want to build a new house in a safe place, where the first thing you have to look at is your house has been flooded over the years. The first thing you have to look at is where to build the new house. And that's the same thing the village of Gays Mills did. They analyzed the landscape around the community, and they wanted to stay within the community boundaries, and they found a site that was high and dry to the north. And after looking at several different sites, they zeroed in on one. And then after that, you know, again, using that similarity to building the house, what kind of house do you want? Along with the village, they had to decide where their community commerce center should be, where their village hall should be, what type of community facilities they want, where they want residential development to occur, where they want commercial development to occur. And through a site design planning process with that FEMA team, they did that. And like I said, the FEMA team came in there in, I think it was, like I said, it was August, and by the end of December, the village of Gays Mills adopted their new site development plan.
How long then did it take to buy out these structures and move everyone?
Well, you could say it's still continuing to this day, but most of it occurred within about a 2-year period.
Has this plan for Gays Mills worked? How do we know that it has worked?
Well, I think it has worked. There's going to be some criticisms, whichever way they decide to go with it, or what site, or how they wanted to redevelop. The site that they have now, like I say, is not going to ever be flooded again. They just had another flood last year where some of the old downtown got inundated again. And I know at least one business decided we are completely done because we administer a microloan fund as well down there, and they decided to move up to the Community Commerce Center and relocate there. So I think it just takes time. And like I say, it's a very safe site, very scenic site, and if you've ever been there, I'm sure you'd agree with that.
I did hear in talking with some local officials, specifically a village leader in Ontario, a concern that Gaze Mills, because of having to relocate their downtown, a concern that the village became segmented in part. And there was a concern that these other villages that are now undertaking this process, a concern that they didn't want to also end up having kind of to segment part of their village. What do you think of that criticism? And is that something that's going to be, I don't know, taken into account?
Well, the village, they make the decision, as the village board and Gaze Mills made that decision, that this is what they wanted, and they voted on it, and that's the decision that they made. The same thing will occur in Ontario as well, as to where they want to relocate, what they want to do. If they want to stay right where they're at, they can, and they can elevate the buildings and fill in basements and things like that. But it's a planning process that we funded. We didn't fund a final end planning product.
Dave, what are your thoughts on the good and the bad that come with these sorts of relocation efforts?
Well, it's never easy to relocate. Especially in the smaller communities, they're sort of historical, and people always do this same way. But you have to weigh being flooded out every year, being closed down, losing that income. Your assessments are really low versus moving to high and dry. It might be 30 seconds, 40 seconds different in a drive of a smaller community. We're not talking a large area. Most likely you'll be able to see from one spot to the next because these are smaller communities. So you have to weigh the goods of being safe, building safe and being there, and being able to expand your business if you're doing good, versus being in a floodplain that you won't be able to expand. You'll be flooded, and it'll cost you time and money every time it floods. But again, like Greg said, it's going to be up to the communities. All we can do is, develop a plan that will offer them options and let them choose what they think is best for their community.
Dave, you laid out some of the steps that are going to happen in this planning process. I wonder if you can talk about kind of the next immediate step for the planning process and kind of what the timeline is for that next initial step.
Well, in the first months here, what we will be developing is an RFP, request for proposal, that will go out to consultants. We will draw up a draft plan, RFP, and then go to each of the communities and fine-tune that RFP so that it meets their specific needs. And then once we send out the RFP, get them back, and then the communities will decide which consultant or consultants to go with. So that'll be the first month and a half, 2 months process of developing that RFP, meeting with the community, fine-tuning it, sending out the RFP, getting responses back, and then having the communities decide which consultant they want to go with.
And do we have a variety of consultants in this area, or will this likely have to draw in expertise from other areas?
Greg, I'll...
Yeah, Greg.
Yes, there are some consultants that are very experienced because working with these communities over the years, there are definitely, I'm not going to get into any names, but there are several of them, and they're quite large, and they're very experienced in dealing with flood recovery planning activities.
How many other, Greg, how many other villages, communities, townships have we seen take on these sorts of kind of mitigation efforts?
Well, back in the 70s, I remember the village of Soldiers Grove did. They relocated and they called it Solar City back in the 1970s. In the 90s, trying to think of the island up in Pierce County, Trenton Island, up in right across from Red Wing, there was a $6 million buyout there of homes and cabins and commercial harbor marinas up there that we were involved with administering a $6 million buyout. The city of Prairie du Chien did one years ago too on St. Farrell Island, a relocation. So it's been done before.
Yeah, I wondered if there is lessons to be learned from that collective history, or, you know, maybe if these projects are better off having this history of other relocation efforts.
Yeah, I think all of them look to see what's been done in the past, and not only here, but across the nation as well. And I think the key to make anything work is let the community decide as to what they want to do. And that's primarily what we did in writing this grant, was to try to put everything together as far as what's needed, but the communities themselves try to determine what steps they want to take and where they want to go with growing in the future.
One of the things is that in the buyouts, FEMA and Wisconsin Emergency Management has mitigation grants yearly and after disasters, and their number one priority is buyouts. So if they buy out a structure, remove it from the floodplain, they'll never be damaged again. However, when you buy out that structure, it has to remain open space. So the community is losing all its tax base and potentially those residences and those businesses. Developing a relocation plan can identify areas where they can then go to. So we're trying to maintain that tax base for those smaller communities.
Yeah, Dave, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the availability of federal or even state funds for the actual relocation process. You know, once these villages have plans in place, how do we know that there is going to be aid for these smaller communities to kind of undertake these big projects?
Every year there's grants available. They're highly competitive. So one of the things about these grants is if you have a plan in place, you're obviously going to be a step above other ones that are applying that don't have a plan. So that's a benefit for them. And there's numerous agencies. FEMA has grants every year. Wisconsin Emergency Management has grants. If a disaster is declared, they get supplemental funding. Other agencies get supplemental funding if there's a disaster declared. So there's a lot of grants available, but so if you have a plan in place, you're a step above those other applicants that don't have a plan or just applying for money.
I also wonder if there is a concern as FEMA faces more natural disasters across the U.S. And kind of more communities needing help. Is there a concern that that money will start to run short?
Your guess is as good as mine. There's more disasters every year, but they seem to get money for them. So I couldn't tell you if there's going to be run out or not. I have no idea.
Greg, I wonder what your thoughts are on the availability of funding as we see more communities kind of grappling with natural disasters.
From what I've seen over the years, is that the funding is always available for a good project that has a lot of public support behind it, where the funding agencies sees that there's going to be a good return on their funding. So if you develop a good project, I think it'll be considered to be competitive, and hopefully it might not be funded the first time or the second time you apply, but maybe the third or fourth time the funding might come through, because it's going to be these relocation activities, like even today, community, like I said, just this last year, another community moved out of the flood, I mean, another business moved out of the floodplain and Gays Mills up to the new site. So it's a continual process, and hopefully that the funding will be available like it has been in the past.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking about a new federal grant that will help four villages along the Kickapoo River build resiliency against future floods. We're here with Greg Flogstad, former director of the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission, and the new director, Dave Boniface. Greg, I wonder if there is a risk of fatigue from village officials for continuing to have to apply for aid. You know, I've talked with Vernon County officials, I've talked with local officials who say, you know, this process of, especially in the immediate aftermath of documenting flooding, but also of just continuing to apply for grants, it really takes a toll on village officials because of the time and involvement that's needed.
You're absolutely right. It's very stressful for these communities to be continually flooded and to have to continually to go through this. It's even stressful on our staff because we're taking on more than what we typically would have to do. We're not an emergency preparedness organization, and a lot of not only our staff but a lot of other county and state agencies that typically aren't involved with flood recovery or emergency recovery activities. It's necessary for us to step up to try to help any way we can. What to do about that? There are some resources out there for people that are having problems and are fatigued and stressed out because of this, but it's probably not enough.
Dave, I wonder what your thoughts are on the toll that this process of applying for grant money and, you know, undertaking big projects like this can take on local villages that don't have a lot of paid village staff.
Yeah, it does. It takes a huge toll on them, and especially being repeated year after year or every few years going through this same thing. So if they can relocate with one big project and eliminate that issue, they won't have that problem in the future. We as a commission will try to do, you know, the best we can for this grant. We'll do all the administration of the grant so the communities don't have to do that part of it. So we're taking that burden off of them, and we're assuming that role. So we're helping out that way. We try to do, you know, step into these communities and help out as best they can, understanding that they don't have the expertise to administer these types of grants, especially the larger ones. So we try to step in and help them there. And again, if we can get one big project and to eliminate all the future ones, it's going to be help them immensely.
Do you think we'll see other communities want to make that sort of investment in kind of their flood resiliency, especially once we, you know, see these villages start to move to the relocation part of this project? Do you think other communities will want to jump on to the board too?
I think in the future there will be other ones, especially if these four communities get up and running and get their a new commerce area or residential areas, and they can show that they're either growing instead of declining. As other communities will look at that, because these smaller communities look to other communities to see what they did to help out. So again, they don't have to reinvent the wheel. So yeah, I think they're, depending on each situation, if we have an increased flooding in the future and larger floods, then yes, there will be more and more that will look towards this.
Greg, how long do these, how long do these like relocation plans look into the future? Is there kind of an expiration date, I guess, of how long, these plans will, I guess, help protect communities from floods?
Well, ideally and hopefully that the decisions they make with these planning funding funds and preliminary engineering funds that's going to be made available to them, is that they will find a site where they can stay forever.
Is that complicated by the fact that we continue to see, more severe flooding incidents and the potential that we are seeing some climate and weather changes?
The sites that I know that they're looking at, I mean, they're like in the 1,000-year floodplain, which would be like it'd be an unbelievable disaster would have to occur for something like them to be flooded again, where some of the sites that they're looking at or where Gaze Mills moved to. So hopefully that it would be just a terrible, terrible disaster that would, flood disaster that would have to occur, that in order for that, some of these sites that they're looking at to be impacted.
Yeah, Dave, I might have you kind of elaborate a little bit about where you guys get that information of, you know, what is the 1,000-year floodplain?
Each county has floodplain maps that are delineated. So there are maps out there that show the floodplain, the 500-year, the 100-year, the 500-year floodplains. So there's maps out there, existing maps out there, that they will look at and do take into consideration when they're doing this study.
And very briefly, as we wrap up here, how long do you expect the planning process to take before villages can start looking towards the next step?
The planning project should take 18 months, approximately 18 months to get completed from start to finish.
Dave Boniface is Executive Director of the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission. He's here with us today with Greg Flogstaff, the former director of the commission, to talk about a new federal grant the commission received to help four villages along the Kickapoo River create a mitigation plan for future flooding. Coming up, we'll hear the featured speaker at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration in La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Each year, the La Crosse community celebrates the life and legacy of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and recognizes local leaders who are working for justice in the La Crosse area. This year's featured speaker started working for civil and human rights as a teenager in Selma, Alabama during the 1960s. She'd participated in the historic march from Selma to Montgomery and experienced police violence firsthand. Joining us today is author and activist Linda Blackman Lowry. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So as I said, you'll be presenting at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration here in La Crosse. Can you share a little bit about what you hope to speak about?
Well, my theme for the entire year of 2020 is history, past, present, and future. The year 2020 is a year of vision. And when you go to an optometrist and he lets you know that you have 20/20 vision, that means you can see clearly now. So I will be speaking to people about seeing clearly the path to the voting booth, the avenues to the different issues that are out there that they can take part in, and encouraging young people, especially, to let them know that they have a voice. It's a powerful voice, and they need to be using their voice to make change.
How do you think history, especially looking back to, you know, the civil rights movement, how do you think knowing that history helps illuminate our future?
Well, history follows history. And during the civil rights movement, children were pivotal in two major parts of legislature during the 60s. That was the Children of Birmingham in 1963. They were attacked, they were jailed, attacked by dogs and water holes and beaten. They were fighting nonviolently for desegregation laws. And those desegregation laws were passed in 1964. As the Children of Selma in 1965 was marching, going to jail, attacked on a bridge. They were fighting for voting rights for our parents and this country. And those voting rights was passed after 5 months of going to jail and being beaten and marching on August 6, 1965. And it gave everyone in this country, especially women, the right to vote. So I parallel those two things and validate the actions of children and how children can be a part of using their voice nonviolently for different issues.
You were one of those children in Selma who were participating in civil rights activism. Can you share a little bit about what your first experience was participating in activism and why you wanted to get involved?
My first experience came when I was 7 years old, when my mother died on September the 19th, 1957. I'm the oldest of four. My grandmother and the older people were talking about she wouldn't have died if she hadn't been colored. Now, growing up in a segregated society, I knew in Selma, white people didn't like black people and black people didn't like white people. But at the age of seven, I saw in my seven-year-old mind that white people hated black people so much that they would let my mother die. And I vowed at the age of seven that when I got big, I would change things, that nobody would ever have to grow up without a mommy again because of the color of her skin. I didn't know getting big would be at the right young age of 13. When I first heard Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak, and he was talking about our parents getting the right to vote and getting it nonviolently. And he said in his speech that you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation. And I heard that. But the second time he said it in his speech, I distinctively heard him say, "Linda, you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation." And I remembered my vow at age seven. And I jumped up saying, "Oh, yes, that's how I'm going to do it." And being in church, of course, my grandmother pulling me down and saying, "Sit down and shut up, child." But I realized then that all the people in this church was with Dr. King and what he was talking about. And also, I realized that that was a way that I could help make change. We were trained in the principles of nonviolence, and we started marching on January 3rd, 1965. And we marched and went to jail and did the things we needed to do to keep our parents from losing their job. And in 1965, we realized, the young people realized that if our parents lost their job, it would break up the family. Much like what is happening at the borders today. So that's why before my 15th birthday, I had been jailed 9 times, twice in a state prison camp, which was a total of 9 days. Marching on what is now known as Bloody Sunday, where over 700 marchers were attacked by Alabama state troopers and the Dallas County sheriff and his posse in an attempt, in our first attempt, to walk from Selma to Montgomery to let then-Governor George Wallace know that even death, and this was after the death of a young man named Jimmy Lee Jackson, who had been shot in a small town called Marion, Alabama, about 30 miles from Selma, and later died in the hospital in Selma. So this march was going to be in his honor, and to let the then Governor George Wallace know that there was no stopping us.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking to author and civil rights activist Linda Blackman Lowry. She's the featured speaker at La Crosse's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration. Linda, I wonder what the adults in your life, your grandmother, perhaps you've mentioned her, you know, what they thought of your involvement in these marches and demonstrations. You know, were they scared for you? Did they support you?
My grandmother and my father and the adults, period, were very supportive of us. My father was more frightened for us, marching and going to jail. He would always say, you know, if you see yourself in danger, you know, turn around, come home. I don't want you hurt. And, but going to jail, one, was a way of getting out of school, but two, was a way of showing that we were determined and committed to doing what we thought and knew would bring about change and would help, you know, our parents. And we didn't know, me, myself, didn't know it would help people around the country. I just thought, seriously, that if my parents, my father and my grandmother, got the right to vote, and the other adults in Selma and Dallas County in the state of Alabama, if they got the right to vote, it would change things, and they could vote in people that would help, you know, people of color.
As you mentioned, you participated in the march on what's now known as Bloody Sunday, that ended in mass police brutality on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. In today's world, where communities continue to struggle with officer-involved violence or in shootings, what lessons do you think people can take away from that march and maybe other experiences during the civil rights movement?
I think that now people need to seriously educate their children on how to protect themselves. When you leave out of your house each day, you don't know what or who you're going to face. And if you're faced with police period, even if it's for a traffic stop, there's you should at least remember the nonviolent. Remember to be nonviolent and not confrontational, but with steady level confrontation, I believe you can win. So I think people should teach their children what to expect out there in that world every day, to encourage them, to make them stronger and what they're going to be facing. Because what we face is not what children are facing now. We didn't face people coming into schools, shooting up the school, and we didn't face that kind of violence. We just faced the hatred of racism, and I want people to know that racism comes in all forms, shapes, and sizes, and to let their children, to educate their children on it. We fail to educate our children on what is happening a lot that tries to destroy, you know, our values. That's why I believe the prisons are so full, and we have so many children dropping out of school and different things like that. So I think our people need to educate and encourage their children.
You mentioned you hope to encourage young people to exercise their voice in your address to the La Crosse community. And I wonder if you can talk about your perspective on, you know, some of the ways we're seeing youth today really stepping up to exercise their voice and organizing marches on things front like climate change and stricter gun laws. You know, in what ways do you see maybe similarities between the youth of today and, you know, youth organizers in the civil rights movement?
The youth of today, I want to say this. I love the song Glory from the movie Selma. In it, Common and John Legend says, "Take the wisdom of the elderly and the energy of the young." And I paraphrase and say, take the wisdom of the elderly, the energy and knowledge of the young people. Because we don't give young people that acknowledgement that they do have knowledge, and that knowledge collectively could change it could change the world. See, in 1965, if someone had told me during the during 2019 to 2020 that I would still be fighting nonviolently for basic human rights. And that's what we are doing now, because all the issues out there, the climate, the women's health issues, the gun violence, gay rights issues, all those issues are human issues, and it affects everybody. What could happen to me could easily happen to you or anyone else. So we need to get back to just being human and recognizing human rights, period.
I want to return to Martin Luther King's words of steady, loving confrontation that you shared earlier, and ask, what does steady, loving confrontation look like today?
It looks like the young lady named Greta that's fighting for climate change, the young people that took on, has taken on the NRA to change gun laws and being successful in many ways. That's what it looks like. It looks like young people going door to door, handing out literature for their favorite candidate in an election. It looks like we're going back to grassroots organizing, and that's what is needed. And I say grassroots organizing because in the 60s, people came to Selma, and people of Selma went door to door trying to educate and encourage people to register to vote. And I love it when I hear people say, we registered 150 people today. And that's good. I love that. But my question to them is, how many of that 150 will go to the polls at any given election and vote? Do you follow up with that 150 after you registered them? Do you educate them to who is on a ballot? What is on a ballot when they get to the polls? If they get to the polls and their name is not there for them to be able to vote at that particular precinct or whatever, what do they need to do to be able to vote? So young people, I think, will bring the circle of human rights to will make it a full circle. And I hope to see that in my lifetime. But steady, loving confrontation, I have used that in my life since the age of 13. And I am now 69. And it works perfectly for me. It's all in how you what those three words mean to you. And you will know how to use them when you recognize the meaning of them to you, the individual.
Very briefly, as we wrap up here, I wanted to take a moment to talk about your book, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, which is now, as you mentioned earlier, before our conversation, being turned into a play. I wonder... I wonder if you could talk about maybe why you feel people are interested in these stories. Maybe what's driving that hunger to hear these stories, not only in your book, but brought to life on the stage?
this is, to me, it is what is needed now, especially among young people, to encourage them and show them that young people do have a voice, and to encourage the and to motivate and encourage the older people to get out and use their voice as well.
Linda Blackman Lowry is an author and civil rights activist from Selma, Alabama. She joined us today ahead of her address at this year's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration in La Crosse. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Our show is produced by senior news editor and producer John Davis. If you missed part of today's program, including our conversation about a new federal grant awarded to communities along the Kickapoo River to address flood mitigation, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.